Next Sunday night is the last Sunday of the month, and we're going to do something that we've been kind of doing traditionally for the last 3 years, I guess, or so. It's an end-of-summer celebration of fellowship. In the past, we've shown slides and videos of all of the summer activities that start with the end-of-summer barbecue. It goes on through Vacation Bible School, the Tahoe Family Encampment, the Yosemite Family Encampment, and all of the other activities that we do during the summer, whether it's youth activities or adult activities or a combination of those. And so next Sunday night, once again, will be a celebration of fellowship, and we'll have a chance to be reminded of some of the things we did this summer that fall into that category and that enrich our fellowship with one another. I hope that you'll be here for it. It's always an uplifting evening. It's always encouraging to see the things that we can kind of look forward to every summer, the things that brings extra spirit to our life. I hope that you'll be here and encourage others to be here for it as well. We've been talking a little bit over the last couple of Sunday nights about the prophets of the Old Testament in particular, and those even more particularly that surrounded the warnings to Israel and to Judah about the things that they needed to correct in their lives in their relationship with God, as well as those prophets that lived with Israel and Judah as they were taken off to captivity, and those that were with them once they returned in part to the land that God had given them, the land of Palestine, the land of Canaan, the land of Israel. We found that the messages of God's prophets came from the known God of the Israelites. This was not some God that they had never heard of before. This was not a God that they had picked up along the way in their travels, but this was the known God of the Israelites, the God that they could trace all the way back to Adam. This God was known to be ever-present, and he was ever aware of all that was happening in all of his world, and that was known about him. He was known to make and to fulfill promises of great blessings as well as of great punishments, so that whatever God said he would do, whatever God promised in terms of a future, God would bring about. This God was known for his compassion also, for saving his people from the consequences of their sins when they repented, and that this God was known for doing that over and over and over, regardless of how many times his people sinned against him, regardless of the nature of the sin, regardless of the fact that so often it was the same sin over and over and over. But even though his people knew these things about him, their God, they often turned away from him. They were, after all, humans. So they needed to be reminded that God is alive and that God is aware of all that goes on, that he is ever existent, that he's not a God like human beings that has a lifespan that may last 100 years or several hundred years, but that God's lifespan is non-existent. He exists forever. They needed to be reminded that God is sovereign over all of the world, not just over a community or a piece of land or even all of the land that they had any knowledge of or even all of this place that we call the earth, but the entirety of the universe. They needed to be reminded that God is holy and that God is jealous of his people's affections. And they needed to be reminded that God is powerful and that God will act to accomplish his plans for the world and for all who are in his world. But don't we all need those kinds of reminders frequently? Don't we often find ourselves caught up in something of the moment? Don't we often find ourselves being drawn away to something that in some way is attractive or enticing or tempting to us? Something, maybe something very small, maybe something very large, but we all struggle with it. And so while it's easy for us to kind of look down upon these people, the Israelites, we have to look at ourselves at the same time, don't we? When we look at them and say, didn't they know? Why didn't they act? We have to look at ourselves and say the same things. And don't we also need to frequently join Isaiah's praise to God in Isaiah 25:1, where he says, O Lord, you are my God. I will exalt you and praise your name, for in perfect faithfulness, you have done marvelous things, things planned long ago. That God had said long, long ago, long before Isaiah ever came on the scene, wonderful things that he would do with and through his people, blessings that he would bring to his people. And he didn't give a time frame, but God brought them about. Every one. God was perfect in faithfulness. Everything he said he would do, he was doing. A relationship with God, with all the blessings that are involved, requires obeying him. But it also requires honoring him by trusting that what he requires is right and that he will take care of his people. Obedience, honor, and trust of God amounts to faithfulness to God. Faithfulness or loyalty to God in all things is expected of people who unite with God in covenant as his family. Marriage is an intimate covenant relationship that has come from God. And by virtue of marriage as that intimate covenant relationship, God gives us a window to understand the relationship that he wants to have with his people. And so God frames his covenant relationship with his people as marriage. And he frames his people as his wife. As a result, disloyalty, dishonoring, disobeying, distrusting him, and positively giving these to another is, in God's mind, adultery to him. In Jeremiah chapter 3, and in verses 6 through 10, God uses these terms to reveal his deep hurt with his precious people. There we find this being said. During the reign of King Josiah, the Lord said to me, "Have you seen what faithless Israel has done? She has gone up on every high hill and under every spreading tree and has committed adultery there. I thought that after she had done all this, she would return to me. But she did not. And her unfaithful sister Judah saw it. I gave faithless Israel her certificate of divorce and sent her away because of all her adulteries. Yet I saw that her unfaithful sister Judah had no fear. She also went out and committed adultery. Because Israel's immorality mattered so little to her, she defiled the land and committed adultery with stone and wood. In spite of all this, her unfaithful sister Judah did not return to me with all her heart, but only in pretense, declares the Lord." I don't know that we can read those words and miss the depth of hurt that God had toward his people. The times he mentions repeatedly the idea of his people being adulterous to him and the immorality and the grossness of distaste that God has for this, and his incredulity that they would do this. How could they do this, it seems he's saying. In Jeremiah chapter 5, and verse 11, God says, "The house of Israel and the house of Judah have been utterly unfaithful to me, declares the Lord." Not mildly, but utterly unfaithful. All of God's people were responsible to God for their ungodliness. And they were also responsible, by way of what God had given in his law, for local discipline of the ungodly among them. So that if someone rose up among them, or someone began worshiping idols among them, the community had the responsibility, as God's people, to deal with it swiftly, according to God's will, and bring it to a swift end. It was not to pollute and take over and become acceptable within the community. But obviously, Israel and Judah had not done this. They had become, as cultures, as societies, utterly unfaithful to God. So God spoke through his prophet Ezekiel to say, "If a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits sin, and does the same detestable things the wicked man does, will he live? God answers that none of the righteous things he has done will be remembered. Because of the unfaithfulness he is guilty of, and because of the sin he has committed, he will die. God is simply saying if a righteous man becomes unrighteous, then he stands with the unrighteous. If a faithful man becomes unfaithful because he pollutes himself and his life with unfaithfulness, what faithfulness he's had in the past is past, and he'll be judged for his unfaithfulness. But in terms of the society as a whole, the unfaithfulness or faithfulness of Israel and Judah rested primarily on their kings and their officials and their priests, all of those who fell into the category of leaders. The monarchies of the northern kingdom, Israel, had many kings who were full of political and military and commercial skills. They were richly blessed natural leaders in so many ways. But Israel rebelled against God's order and by virtue of that, God's covenant. The prophet Hosea in chapter 4 indicates Israel's unfaithfulness and the consequences. As we read in chapter 4 in verses 1 through 4, "Hear the word of the Lord, you Israelites, because the Lord has a charge to bring against you who live in the land. There is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. There is only cursing, lying, and murder, stealing, and adultery. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed." Can you imagine the picture that God is painting? One that we can't really imagine fully, can we? But God doesn't stop. "Because of this, the land mourns, and all who live in it waste away. The beasts of the field and the birds of the air and the fish of the sea are dying." You cause to wonder what's going on here. Is this simply some kind of poetic language that God is using to try to drive home how bad things have gotten in terms of the morals of the land? Or is he talking about people having become so careless and uncaring about everything they did to people and animals and land and all other resources itself, that everything is suffering from it? But he didn't stop. He says, "But let no man bring a charge, let no man accuse another, for your people are like those who bring charges against a priest." How could that be? Priests were supposed to be the holiest of God's people. They were the ones who stood as intermediaries between God and his people. They were the ones who took care of the sacrifices for God's people. They were the ones who were responsible for teaching God's people about God's will. They were the people who were to keep themselves in every way unpolluted from the world. And yet, charges could be brought against priests. In verse 9, God picks up again to say, "And it will be like people, like priests. I will punish both of them for their ways and repay them for their deeds." So indeed, even the people who were to be the holiest, those who were to be the purveyors of God's word, those who were to draw the people to God, were debased. And then in verse 15, God says again, "Though you commit adultery, O Israel, let not Judah become guilty. Do not go to Gilgal, do not go up to Beth-Aven, and do not swear, as surely as the Lord lives." To him, for them to say that was taking his name in vain, because they were not living according to his will. They were simply using God as they thought they could. Little did they know. The southern kingdom, Judah, had kings of David's line. They reigned in the chosen place and within covenant norms, but the nation as a whole was not faithful to God, nor were most of their kings. One of the few faithful kings of Judah was Jehoshaphat. In 2 Chronicles chapter 18 and verses 8 through 10, we read about Jehoshaphat and the kind of man that he was.
It says, in Jerusalem also, Jehoshaphat appointed some of the Levites, priests, and heads of Israelite families to administer the law of the Lord and to settle disputes, and they lived in Jerusalem. He gave them these orders, which tells a great deal about the kind of man and the kind of king Jehoshaphat was. You must serve faithfully and wholeheartedly in the fear of the Lord. In every case that comes before you from your fellow countrymen who live in the cities, whether bloodshed or other concerns of the law, commands, decrees, or ordinances, you are to warn them not to sin against the Lord. Otherwise, his wrath will come on you and your brothers. Do this, and you will not sin.
Chapter 20 of that same book of 2 Chronicles tells about Jehoshaphat's trust in God under the most threatening circumstances, and because of that, God's aid that brought him victory over his enemy. Later on in 2 Chronicles chapter 31, and in verses 20 through 21, we read about another one of those few faithful kings of Judah by the name of Hezekiah. And there in chapter 31 and verses 20 through 21, it says this of King Hezekiah of Judah. This is what Hezekiah did throughout Judah, doing what was good and right and faithful before the Lord his God. In everything that he undertook in the service of God's temple and in obedience to the law and the commands, he sought his God and worked wholeheartedly, and so he prospered. There's a direct link between faithfulness to God and God's blessings. And Hezekiah experienced it. But there's more in 2 Chronicles about the kings of Judah that was not as complimentary. Because in chapter 26 and verses 16 through 21, we read that after King Uzziah of Judah became powerful, he also became unfaithful to God. And God punished him. Chapter 28 tells of King Ahaz, and chapter 36 tells of King Zedekiah, both of them who were unfaithful to God. And in this kind of environment, we find Isaiah, or God crying out rather, through the prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 1 and verses 21 through 26, about his people. We read, "See how the faithful city has become a harlot," speaking of Jerusalem. "She once was full of justice, righteousness used to dwell in her, but now murderers. Your silver has become dross. Your choice wine is diluted with water. Your rulers are rebels, companions of thieves. They all love bribes and chase after gifts. They do not defend the cause of the fatherless. The widow's case does not come before them. Therefore, the Lord Almighty, the Mighty One of Israel, declares, 'Ah, I will get relief from my foes and avenge myself on my enemies. I will turn my hand against you. I will thoroughly purge away your dross and remove all your impurities. I will restore your judges as in days of old, your counselors as in the beginning. Afterward, you will be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city.'" God would change what was. He would return it to its beauty. He would return it to its faithfulness. He would return it to what he intended it to be. Being faithful to God brought blessings, but being unfaithful to God's covenant brought about the covenant curses that had been promised back in Deuteronomy chapter 28. And again, it comes back to leaders. God's leaders were responsible for maintaining God's covenant as what we would today call national policy. That was the way the entire nation was to function. It was not a democracy. It was not a dictatorship. It was a theocracy. In truth, the king was not simply these men, but it was God Almighty. God was the one who had taken care of his people, provided for his people, given them a law that was both civil and religious. Everything that they did was under the auspices of God. And so it was that they were responsible to God. The leaders then must be godly men who required their people to obey God. That was not simply an edict that they would put out, but it was something that they would make sure happened, and they would enforce it. Leaders would be people who would have strength of character to practice and to judge what was right. They must teach their people what is right and discipline them when they do not do what is right to bring them back to the right. That sounds perhaps very controlling, very demanding, very stiff and unyielding, but that was God's law, because God understood full well that once his people were allowed to start drifting, once even one person within the camp started that, it would spread like a virus, and it would overtake them, as it in fact did for centuries. These leaders must be men who are not fearful of anyone or anything, real or potential, except God himself. God condemned his people's leaders for being the opposite of such men in Ezekiel chapter 34. When King Ahaz of Judah was under attack by his enemies, the prophet Isaiah told him, "If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all." Those are words for any time, aren't they? For you and I, whether kings or leaders or not, if we do not stand firm in our faith, we will not stand at all. And yet, despite his people's unfaithfulness, God remained faithful to them. After God brought them back to their land, Zechariah chapter 8 and verses 7 through 8 has this to say: "This is what the Lord Almighty says, I will save my people from the countries of the east and the west. I will bring them back to live in Jerusalem. They will be my people, and I will be faithful and righteous to them as their God." That is a very generous and merciful and forgiving God, isn't it? As far as his people had moved away from him, with all of their sins, with all of their rejection, God still loved them. God punished them. He disciplined them, to be sure. But he still loved them, and he still took care of them. During the greatest unfaithfulness and sin that his people were involved in, God had great hopes for his people. And so in Jeremiah chapter 3, and in verses 14 through 25, we find God pleading with his people as he hoped for their return. And we read these words: "Return, faithless people, declares the Lord, for I am your husband. I will choose you, one from a town and two from a clan, and bring you to Zion. Then I will give you shepherds after my own heart, who will lead you with knowledge and understanding. In those days when your numbers have increased greatly in the land, declares the Lord, men will no longer say, 'The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord.' It will never enter their minds or be remembered. It will not be missed, nor will another one be made. At that time, they will call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord. And all nations will gather in Jerusalem to honor the name of the Lord. No longer will they follow the stubbornness of their evil hearts. In those days, the house of Judah will join the house of Israel, and together they will come from a northern land to the land I gave your forefathers as an inheritance. I myself said, 'How gladly would I treat you like sons and give you a desirable land, the most beautiful inheritance of any nation.' I thought you would call me father and not turn away from following me. But like a woman unfaithful to her husband, so you have been unfaithful to me, O house of Israel, declares the Lord. A cry is heard on the barren heights, the weeping and pleading of the people of Israel, because they have perverted their ways and have forgotten the Lord their God. Return, faithless people, I will cure you of backsliding. Yes, we will come to you, for you are the Lord our God. Surely the idolatrous commotion on the hills and mountains is a deception. Surely in the Lord our God is the salvation of Israel. From our youth, shameful gods have consumed the fruits of our fathers' labor, their flocks and herds, their sons and daughters. Let us lie down in our shame, and let our disgrace cover us, We have sinned against the Lord our God, both we and our fathers. From our youth till this day, we have not obeyed the Lord our God." God foresaw that in great hope, and so it occurred. Oh no, not all of Israel and Judah, only what would be called a remnant, a portion, and a small portion at that. Those who were faithful to him. Believing trust in God, wholehearted repentance, and obedience to his covenant was the means of deliverance from destruction from God's people. Through these, the faithful would be saved. And that is God's unchanging principle. An intimate, loving relationship with God as master produces faithfulness to him. Maybe I should say that again. An intimate, loving relationship with God as master produces faithfulness to him. Faithfulness, loyalty, trust, obedience, and love. Those characterize God's people of all time. Each of us has to ask ourselves, are these things true of me? If there is a faith issue that you need to deal with publicly, whatever it may be, this is a good time to deal with it as we stand together and sing.
Have you been?